The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
We have a pretty, despite all the complaints about our economy, that it should be growing at 100 times the speed it is, depending on which party you belong to. The fact of the matter is there's probably no economy in the world that we would trade places with. And so my question to you, I'm curious, what is the linchpin in the economy, in your opinion? There's a lot of people who are, you know, kind of walking on eggshells right now, feeling like we're coming to the end of a cycle. That it's been a long recovery, a slow recovery, but a long one. I'm curious whether there's any one thing that would keep you up at night that you think could be kind of that linchpin, or maybe a couple different linchpins that you're that concern you that could tip the economy back into its into a correction or a temporary downturn.
Yeah, so I mean, we obviously look at a lot of factors as it relates to the economy. You know, one that's critically important to us and our business is how fast our business is growing. So the overall health of businesses, and we see that as being very healthy right now. If you look at corporate profits. You know, the numbers were good in 2016. I think in 2017, you know, the sense is that they will continue to be quite good and that there is good business growth out there. So if that leaves us for whatever reason, whether credit becomes tighter or companies just become more concerned in terms of where the economy is going, then clearly that can move things in the wrong directions, in the wrong direction. Jobs, obviously, is also a critical component piece. Again, we like what we're seeing in terms of job creation and job growth, and we would say both domestically and internationally, we feel good about that. But if that were to turn, you know, that clearly could create some concerns. And then I think there's been favorable reaction for this administration in terms of regulatory reform, in terms of taxes, all of those kinds of things. Healthcare obviously was one that didn't get out of the gate all that well. And so to the extent that there's a string of those kinds of things that don't seem to move in the direction that I think most have high hopes that they will, that clearly can have an impact on the markets and where things go. So those would be a few things that I would mention.
What are the most important characteristics that William Blair Private Wealth Division possesses that attracts and retains clients? Where are those clients coming from? How are you attracting them, and where are they coming from? And then secondarily, it's one thing to attract them; it's another thing to keep them.
Sure. So I think as we look at kind of where we're sourcing clients from, you know, it's a variety of places. You know, on the business side of things. We clearly bring in a fair amount of business from those businesses that are undergoing change of some sort. So whether they're going public, whether they're being sold, they're being recapitalized. So there's a fair amount of that going on, obviously across the economy, and most of those have an impact on individuals where it's creating somewhat of a liquidity event. And we want to be in those places to capture those liquid assets. You know, we do deal with a lot of C-suite executives, and so really focusing in on those kinds of individuals is something that we can source a lot of business. You know, there's a lot of wealth that's changing hands, as we all know. So inheritance. You know, is a big part of what's playing out right now, and you've seen the statistics in terms of how much wealth transfer is taking place. And in many cases, you know, that next generation is really looking for a different provider than what their parents or grandparents may have aligned themselves with in the past. So all of those would be, great opportunities. We also leverage our clients, and maybe that dovetails into the second part of your question. But our clients represent a great referral source, whether that's to other family members, to business partners, to other friends within their network, and to the extent that they're satisfied, they create the best story possible to that person that they're trying to refer into us. So I would say all of those, are really important in terms of where we're attracting clients. I think in terms of why we're able to maintain and retain clients, and we have very high retention rates that we're proud of over a long number of years. And I would say, that's for a variety of reasons. I would say it starts with our people and both the caliber of our team as well as the stability of that team. So we have individuals that have been here for a very long time. We have very low turnover. And in the high net worth space, really building a relationship over time and for a long time is important to clients. And so we've definitely been able to leverage that given our business model that we have. We truly are client-centric. I was with another institution that was much larger in size, and I think given so many headwinds that bigger and more public companies face, we don't, and so we have the luxury, I think, of being much more focused around our clients and focused on doing the right thing by those clients, and so it's resulted in a very high level of stability and a very high level of service and fortunately satisfaction on the part of clients. I think the product offering, the solutions that we can bring to clients are incredibly important. And we obviously have a very narrow focus. We're focused around investments. We don't have trust powers, and we're not doing any kind of significant lending, although we have margin lending that we can do. But we're not distracted by a lot of those other things, and so we're both very deep and very competent in terms of those investment capabilities. And we're what we consider a global boutique, and so look and act strong or small, but in reality, we're an international company, and so we've got presence and access to capabilities that would represent a company much larger than ours. So I would say those are a handful of reasons why we're able to develop really strong and long relationships with clients.
So when you talk about being client-centric, William Blair's got its own funds that are available. And a lot of times people feel that anytime an organization has its own funds, there's the urgency to steer people in that direction, that maybe advisors are even incentivized to sell their own funds rather than funds that maybe are more suitable. What about that? What about what at William Blair? Is there? How do you resist the pressure to steer more dollars into William Blair funds versus funds that are available from any number of other organizations?
Yeah. So I would just take one step back, and then I'll get to your question. If we look at how we customize portfolios for clients, we typically start with a piece that is highly customized in terms of individual securities, both on the fixed income and the equity side. And so obviously that's just going out into the market and using our research to identify which of those companies make the most sense to be invested in. We do have the proprietary institutional platform that you're talking about, which has both the ability for us to invest in mutual funds as well as separately managed accounts. And then we have an open architecture platform that we call consulting services, which gives us access to best of breed managers across all asset classes, strategies, that is also available. So as we're constructing client portfolios, I will tell you we are agnostic in terms of where we go and how we construct those portfolios. So there is no greater incentive for one of our advisors to use a William Blair fund versus an outside manager fund, or to put more money in the, you know, custom portion of the portfolio. So we really want to know and listen to our client and know what our client is interested in, and then we want to, based upon that and their risk tolerance and their objectives, we want to put together the most optimal portfolio that we possibly can. So we have clients which would have no William Blair funds for whatever reason, and we have some that would have, you know, a decent amount of exposure. But we really have been objective and agnostic, and I think it shows in terms of what our portfolios look like, which is incredibly important. Having said all of that, if you look at the track record of William Blair's performance, you know, over the long period, 5 years and 10 years for our funds, we've had some outstanding performance across those different funds. And so to the extent that it truly does represent the best in class, then, you know, we're going to be very comfortable putting a client in those. To the extent that changes, you know, we're just as quick to move out of those investments as well.
Why have your own funds at all? I mean, on the one hand, you're saying that they've done very well. They won't always do well, because no funds always do well. Is there not an advantage to saying, look, we are agnostic, period, and because we have none of our own funds, we're completely independent, and as good as our funds do, or did, there's funds out there that do just as well, and there's enough funds, and we're not creating any funds that do something that just don't exist elsewhere. So, I mean, is it just a legacy thing for William Blair, or has there ever been any discussion as to what's the real purpose of having these funds at all when there's so much out in the market and we have so much access to it and we have this very agile platform that we can use to get best in class?
Yeah, well, so obviously some in the industry have moved to, you know, really just offering outside funds. We think we can do both. So we think we can be objective and agnostic, but we also see, you know, benefit in what we have within our own four walls, which in many cases are top performing funds that are out there. And to the extent that they are, you know, we think there's some advantages to, you know, placing a client within one of those funds. You know, we literally work with those teams on a day in and day out basis. We have full information flow that's going back and forth, so we're very familiar with what's going on within those funds and how decisions are being made. And so we think, you know, as an investment company who specializes in investment management, being able to leverage some of those relationships and some of that direct access and firsthand knowledge is worth something. And as long as it doesn't take away from the objectivity, then we think we can do both. So again, for us, we're comfortable doing that. We think we do it well. But as I said, to the extent that, you know, we have a client that has concerns about that, or we think that we just can't perform as well as what's available externally within that given strategy, you know, we quickly will move to the outside manager. So, again, it's a philosophy, but it's a philosophy that has worked well for us over the years.
So let's talk a little bit about the open architecture offering that you've got in the private wealth group. Tell me about that, John. How does that work? And tell me about some of the advantages to that. It sounds like you're saying that even separate accounts are constructed and managed through that platform.
We do, yeah. So we have both separate accounts as well as mutual funds and ETFs. So we have passive investments that we can get to as well. So we have a team of research analysts that is dedicated to focusing in on outside managers and finding best of breed outside managers that can augment and complement you know, our capabilities or replicate our capabilities. And so This team of individuals, you know, has a universe of managers that they're following on an ongoing basis, many of whom we've had conversations for years, and yet they're not on the platform, and others that have been on the platform for some period of time. But, you know, they're essentially looking for, you know, those best of breed. Some of those would be more vanilla names that you may see at larger institutions, but many of them, you know, would be, you know, more exclusive names, smaller managers that aren't looking to connect with J.P. Morgan or Bank of America, but are looking for, you know, smaller allocations and someone who understands the investment space at a deeper level. Many of our alternatives fit into that category where we've been able to essentially align ourselves with what we consider incredibly high-quality managers that, you know, really become somewhat more exclusive in terms of access because we're able to connect with them in a different way than some of our larger competitors would.
So the typical wealth advisory firm out there, the way I understand they're constructed, is you have a chief investment officer, you've got that person's lieutenants, they kind of say, here's the strategy, here's the funds that we're recommending, and then the advisors in the field basically follow those marching orders. What you're talking about here, there's a lot of talk about customization, that each client's different and you customize, but is your structure not the same where you've got experts at the top, people who are really putting the shoulder to the wheel on this one and figuring out where client dollars should be going? Is that the case? And if that is the case, I mean, how are you able to customize in a way that maybe differentiates William Blair from other firms that does more off-the-shelf type of solutions?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, in terms of, you know, what you described with somebody who's, you know, heading up that investment side and has perspective and then a broader research team that's going out and trying to research and understand what managers are best to bring onto the platform, I think that's consistent in terms of what we look like. I think the difference is that there's great connectivity in our firm across those professionals that do that in terms of looking at the outside managers and our financial advisors themselves. So we have, as a firm, 100 advisors. So, you know, many firms have thousands or tens of thousands of advisors where you can't have that intimate relationship and you can't sit down and say, let's talk about this real estate investment and whether it really is appropriate for this client. We're able to do that. So as we're onboarding a new client and looking at asset allocation as an example, there's somebody from that consulting services team oftentimes sitting at the table, sitting down directly with that advisor and a wealth planner, as an example, really thinking about what makes the most sense for that client given, you know, that client's situation. So it does become much more customized than it would look like in a lot of different environments that are out there. So it's that connectivity that I think brings a lot of additional value to our clients and allows us to, you know, really come up with what we see as the best solution. Having said all of that, we don't have hundreds of outside managers, and so those managers that we do have, we know exceptionally well, and you know, and oftentimes we're going back to those same managers, you know, across many different portfolios because we like what the manager represents. So again, I think, you know, the top half of the picture may look very similar. I think the bottom half of the picture looks very different, which allows us to really do that additional customization.
Interesting. Okay. So what about growth? Is the division, the private wealth division, on a growth trajectory right now?
Yeah, no, growth is you know, clearly part of, you know, where we are and what we're focused on. And we're doing, you know, a lot of things to make sure that we continue to grow. We've continued to build out our team, and that's adding financial advisors, that's adding wealth planners, that's adding other folks that can support the client process, including client service associates. We've continued to expand our footprint. So we've got a private wealth office now in Atlanta, one in Boston, one soon to be in New York. Ryan may have talked a little bit about that, but that's clearly part of the equation. We have a great investment bank that's part of William Blair, and so we're able to leverage that relationship. And I talked earlier about liquidity events that take place, and obviously we have to respect and keep in line with all of the Chinese walls that are out there. But we're able to connect with a lot of those liquidity events, and so that represents, you know, a real part of our growth engine. We're also, you know, using technology, you know, much more effectively. So you talked about that before in terms of where industries are going. We're able to leverage technology in terms of, you know, how we service our clients, how clients access us, how we analyze portfolios. And that's giving our team more time to spend with clients in terms of deepening relationships or being a part of, you know, finding new business opportunities out there.
Obviously, you guys are feeling that the, you know, things are growing, things are working well. But if I was to ask you, what's the growth strategy going forward? Typically, organizations don't just say more of the same. They tend to think in terms of next steps. I'm wondering if you would have a response to that, John, in terms of you know, how that growth strategy may take on some additional dimensions.
Sure. Yeah, so I guess I would start by saying, you know, any kind of growth would be in the context of, you know, the firm's vision and values. So, you know, we do have a very successful legacy firm that you know, has served as the foundation and served us incredibly well for over 80 years. And so, you know, any kind of change that we would be looking at would be mindful of that and respectful of that and make sure that we maintain it. But I think in terms of some of the other pieces that that you talked about, you know, we just talked about the geographic footprint. You know, we do think that going where our clients are, and there are obviously a lot of wealth pockets across the country, you know, is a clear opportunity for us, you know, to service our clients. I think we continue to look at our solutions offering and how we can evolve that solutions offering. So whether it's in, you know, multi-asset class or whether it's in alternatives, we do think that there continue to be new opportunities, fixed income, new opportunities that are out there. And so we have a product development or solutions development team that is always hard at work, and we will continue to look for those kinds of opportunities to offer new and different things, and that clearly can be a source of growth. I mentioned the investment bank and making sure that we're really leveraging that relationship, definitely a part of it. Growing our team and having more feet on the street, you know, is incredibly important. Having the wealth planning aspect of more and more of our relationships, you know, fully engaged is really important to us. We know as we try to deepen relationships, we do that by knowing and better understanding our clients, and oftentimes that's working with them as they're moving through life stages, and that we're really able to help them, whether it's you know, getting married, getting divorced, moving through a parent's death, figuring out how to transition wealth, you know, all of those kinds of things. The deeper that we are on that side of the relationship, the deeper those relationships become, and it's been a real source of additional assets for us. And then I would say technology is playing a big part of it. And so as we look at, you know, where we are in terms of our technology offering, you know, how clients can access us, that becomes, you know, a bigger and bigger part of the client decisioning process. is what are you able to offer in terms of access to information, analytics that I can do on my own or that you can do on my behalf, all of those kinds of things. So, I mean, it's kind of a broad list, but I would say, you know, all of those things are, you know, clearly part of, you know, where we want to take the business. And we're not a group to sit still. While we've been at it for over 80 years, the firm has really continued to, you know, look for how we evolve the organization. And I think if you look at the overall growth of the firm, you know, particularly over the last 10 or 20 years, you can see we didn't get that by just doing the same thing over and over again, but we got there based upon really evolving our capabilities and bringing in new people with new skill sets and moving into you know, new solutions that have really helped us fuel the growth of the firm.
So let me ask you, as far as pressure from clients in terms of, not pressure, but kind of their desires, if we were to talk about alternatives or even more specifically real assets, where do they want to be? Where do you hear, I mean, is it, you know, hey, real estate, people understand real estate, they think it's a good place to be, or, gee, I've read the McKinsey & Company report, and the world needs, you know, infrastructure to the tune of trillions of dollars, so I want to be in infrastructure. Where's the bottom-up pressure coming from your clients in terms of here's where I feel like I need to be?
Yeah. So first I would say, you know, a lot of clients rely on us to really inform them as to, you know, where the markets are moving and where to, you know, improve in terms of diversification, where to take advantage of some of those market dynamics that you described. But in some cases, clients come to us with very definite opinions. You know, I would say the two that you mentioned, you know, are clearly areas that are in favor now. So, you know, in terms of infrastructure, while we went through, you know, a tougher, you know, number of years in terms of things like MLPs, you know, we feel like they're back and back with a vengeance. You know, I think a lot of the structural changes that needed to happen with some of those investment vehicles has definitely played out. And so I think they're better positioned than they ever have been. And I think in terms of the infrastructure build-out that you described and certainly that this administration is focused on, you know, is a real positive thing. In terms of the real estate market, I think there's been a tremendous amount of interest and a tremendous amount of more recent success in terms of, you know, the real estate market following, you know, the downturn in 2008 and 9, 10 and into 11. But, you know, I think we're in a very good spot there. We've had some real success in multifamily on the real estate side with some new offerings that we've brought through our consulting services group to our clients, and you know, in many cases we've oversubscribed even what was allocated to us, and so we know the demand is quite good there. The returns have been quite good. It's a specific type of real estate, so it's not all real estate, but I think we, you know, we've definitely seen some success. So I would say those two are very much hot areas. If you look at hedge funds, for example, not so much. You know, we've certainly used those in portfolios from time to time, but less focus and reliance on those versus, you know, the two others that I just described. So just some general feelings there.
How many different investment funds do you guys offer? Let's just talk about William Blair for a minute. How many different, roughly, I don't expect an exact number, but how many different funds or investment vehicles does William Blair offer to the individual or family?
Yeah, so you know, first I think you have to look at, you know, the customization that we do, which then that would be, you know, thousands of so-called funds. So that's a big part of what we do. So it's sometimes harder to talk about numbers, but if you're talking about institutional proprietary strategies, and Tony can give you the exact number, but it's somewhere around 35 to 40 strategies that we would have.
Yeah, and Mike, just so you know, like, they have access to a lot, but they pare it down with the research that they're doing.
Oh, sure. Right. Yeah. Yeah, thousands and thousands of opportunities, but you guys figure out where the where the real opportunities are, what's actually creating some yield and whatnot.
So we would go through quantitative and qualitative analysis and screens, and really boil that down so that it's a much more manageable number. So you know, whether you call that 100, but that we again are very closely linked to that, and you know, feel very good about what kind of opportunity it offers.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I'm not sure that you'd be able to answer this off the cuff, but in terms of real asset alternatives, and then as a subset of alternatives, real assets, if we could talk, let's just talk alternatives to start with. Is there an average in, I'm trying to remember whether I brought this up with Ryan or not, Tony, but I was asking, or I want to ask, what percentage of your average portfolio is going to, what percentage of alternatives would be in the average portfolio? I realize that's a difficult question because you have some clients who are just, you know, worth tremendous amounts of money, are very liquid. Others are probably much smaller clients. So, but is there a way to kind of get at that, or is there a target for alternatives or real assets within each client portfolio?
Yeah, there's definitely not a target. So you know, you really do have to look at it client by client, and that's everything from, you know, the size of that client. So you know, there's obviously a big difference between a $5 million client and a $50 million client in terms of what kind of purpose or place, you know, do alternatives have in that portfolio. But you also have to look at it in terms of that client's situation. You know, what kind of real estate are they holding? Many of our clients are business owners, and so they've already got significant exposure to private equity in their own firm, let alone trying to invest in others. So I would really struggle to, you know, to answer that question other than to say, you know, our larger clients, and so I would define that as clients $10 million and above that, you know, our qualified investors are going to have, you know, exposure to alternatives typically, and some would have higher levels of exposure. But still, it's you know, within in a realm. I mean, we're certainly not, you know, a foundation type approach where, you know, you're seeing the majority of assets within alternatives. Ours would be a smaller part of the portfolio, and rightfully so. But I would struggle to give you, you know, a specific number, given we've got a broad range of clients, and we, as I said to begin with, we definitely don't have a target per se that we use on a client basis.
You don't have people coming in saying, I want the Yale endowment model. I want you to just replicate what they're doing. They're knocking it out of the park. I'm worth, you know, $900 million. Just go ahead and build it. Build it just the way Swenson's doing it over there at Yale.
Yeah, no, we don't have that. And frankly, if they said that, we're not the right asset manager for them.
Why is that? Why would you say you're not the right asset manager for them?
Well, because I think that in terms of you know, what we see as appropriate diversification for someone, an individual, you know, we would say something much more diversified would make more sense. And then I would say, just in terms of, you know, what our offerings are, I mean, while we have robust offerings, you know, to the extent that we were, you know, putting in positions that represented 5 or 7 or 8% of their portfolio within a given alternative offering, again, that's not going to leverage, you know, our broader know-how and capability and our overall philosophy in terms of how we do asset allocation. So we would just simply say there are probably, if you're really just focused on alternatives and you want it to represent 70% of your portfolio, there are probably other asset managers that are out there that are structured more in that way that could provide more advice and more value than we may be able to, given our orientation.
There's a lot of people who are, I know institutional investors are very much talking about whether they're actually following through on it, and I assume they are. taking a defensive posture at this point, thinking more in terms of debt than equity in their portfolios. Not necessarily more debt than equity, but changing the balance. And I'm curious whether when you're dealing with individual and family portfolios, do you find yourself as an organization adopting a more defensive posture right now because of fears of, or just expectations that, you know, interest rates are starting to go up and may go up more, inflation could suddenly break loose? Is there any effort to be a little bit more defensive, or are you guys staying the course?
Yeah, well, you know, first I would say that, you know, for that high net worth individual, you know, we tend to operate over very long time horizons, and so the need to be more tactical in nature looks different in a high net worth portfolio than it does in the institutional side of the business. But having said that, no, I mean, I think we pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the market and what makes the most sense. You know, fixed income has not been heavily in favor over the course of the last 5 years or so, given where rates have been. So we've looked at other alternatives out there, including the alternative asset class, but looked at, you know, high-quality dividend-paying equities, you know, as a place where you can have, you know, a little bit more safety and stability, but at the same time have income that's being produced off of that investment. In terms of fixed income where we've gone, we've tended to stick with shorter durations so that as interest rates start to tick higher, you know, we don't get ourselves caught in the wrong crosswinds there. So I would say, you know, absolutely, you know, there's a tactical piece, and times where we're going to be more defensive, and then other times we're going to be more offensive. But it's not going to look like the same approach as it would on the institutional side, where I think you find those institutions being much more tactical in terms of you know, making shorter term changes.
Who do you see as your biggest competitor? I mean, whether it's another organization or a set of organizations, or just some other dynamic that's out there in the you know, demographically or psychographically, who's William Blair's biggest competitor?
Yeah, so in terms of competition, there is not the biggest competitor out there. As you know, the private wealth space you know, is pretty broad and broken up, so there aren't you know, dominant players, as there are in a lot of industries. I mean, there's some large players that are out there, but they're met by, you know, a whole host of mid-sized and smaller players as well. So, and we compete against all of those. I mean, we'll go up against the biggest private banks. Some will go up against more boutique-like asset managers. You know, RIAs, you know, we're competing with on a regular basis. You know, some are more, you know, really local. Some could be a little bit more regional in nature, but so it's really across the board in terms of where we see the competition. So I can't be more precise than that.
So let's talk about the last couple questions here, John, and I'll let you go. I'm curious about where you see the industry. How do you think the industry will change in the next 5 to 10 years? There's been so much talk about technology, but I think also just people having access to information. I sometimes compare it to a doctor's visit, where it used to be you went into the doctor was basically God, and you just did what the doctor said. Nowadays, doctors will tell you that they come in with a sheaf of papers that they printed off the internet, and will tell the doctor, you know, this is what's wrong with me, and here's the drugs I want. I'm not sure that it works that way in your business, but how do you see, you know, regardless of that, what's really, how is the industry, do you expect it to change in the next 5 to 10 years, or maybe even a little bit longer time frame than that?
Yeah. So you know, I would definitely say in terms of the data side of things, I think there's the expectation that that data is used much more aggressively than maybe it has been in the past, so that the analytical side of how we do business, which again we would say we've always been quite deep and aggressive in, but I think that only continues to increase, and I think clients have that expectation. They may not want to know every nuance, but they want to know that you do have that deep analytical capability and that you're taking into account, you know, all of the factors that could be driving markets or driving a sector or whatever it may be. So I do think, you know, that's a big part of it. I do think, you know, there's going to continue to be significant pricing pressure in the marketplace. We're obviously seeing that today much more on the institutional side than we are on the high net worth side, but I think it's out there, no doubt, and we're in the midst of those conversations more often than we have in the past, and so I think that will continue to be a real factor in terms of how we do business on a go-forward basis. I do think you've got the regulatory side of things that continues to play a significant role, and whether we have DOL exactly the way it looks, or you know, we're knocking on wood that we'll have a bit of a deferral at least, and that it will likely look a little bit different than what's outlined. But there's no question that the regulatory side of things is becoming more and more significant. And I think it will continue to cause consolidation in the market. I think of a lot of much smaller RIAs and brokers that, frankly, just don't have the technology or the infrastructure to really meet all of those regulatory requirements that are out there. And so in some cases, it's just going to be easier for them to sell to somebody else or to close down their business. Definitely, we talked about earlier kind of product solutions changing and evolving. I think that's, a big part of what we see. And obviously, there's a lot of discussion right now in terms of active versus passive. And I don't see that leaving the equation anytime soon. And so I think there's real pressure on active managers like ourselves to continue to demonstrate where we can add value. But nonetheless, I think, we'll continue to see some industry shifts. We're seeing them right now, but into more passive strategies. So, I mean, those would be some of the things that, we would talk about. We know it's an incredibly dynamic environment, and, you've got to be on top of all of those things. Again, not look to do things like you've always done them, but continue to adjust and adapt, which, we're working hard to make sure we stay in front of.
So last question, John. You had mentioned retention of employees, long-term employees. Tony had talked to me about that as well, kind of characterized himself as a rookie at 26 years, and there being so many long-term employees. What is it about the ethos at William Blair? Because this is pretty unusual these days. I mean, to have companies where people spend an entire career or decades in the same place, a lot of times companies don't even want that from their people. They like to turn and burn, or they just feel like, you can really get a lot out of them for 7 to 10 years. Then it turns into kind of that velvet coffin, and they really don't want people around with that kind of attitude. What is it about William Blair what is it about the ethos at William Blair that keeps people around and obviously performing at a pretty high level?
Yeah. So, and we would add to those numbers. So, our average advisor has been with us 20 years, has 30 years of industry experience. So, we see that across the firm, which I think definitely helps us in a big way. I would say, the culture of William Blair, is clearly unique. We allow people to really apply their skills and their knowledge of the business and leverage their experience in ways that looks very different than larger institutions. So we're very collaborative in nature, and yet at the same time, we give people the space to be more entrepreneurial in nature and to be client focused. What I talked about before, we really do focus on the long term with clients and doing the right thing and putting our advisors in a decision making mode where they can really act on the best interest of their client and the best interest of the firm. And so I think there's more latitude to do all of that. I do think we take really good care of our people. We value them, and we spend a lot of time making sure that they know that they're valued, whether it's giving them a seat at the table as we're making important decisions, or whether it's making sure that they're recognized and rewarded for good things that they're doing, or whether it's kind of the softer side and dealing with them in the context of what they're going through in terms of their personal lives, and making sure that, you know, we're there for them and that we can be flexible and we can be supportive however we need to be. So I would say all of those things, definitely are part of the culture. I do think that we hire very competent people, and I think everybody would probably say that, but having come from another firm, I clearly see that we have an A team in place that are really passionate about what they do, and they want to win with other people that are very much in that same mold, and I think that they can they can find that. So the other couple of things that I would mention: one, we let our associates be very involved in things that are important to them outside of William Blair, and so we're supportive in terms of getting involved in different organizations and getting involved in their communities. And we also support them in terms of other things that they want to get involved in. So professional associations, we have a very high percentage of our advisors that have their CFAs, and we really support them in kind of every aspect as they're trying to pursue them. So in terms of that professional development as well, I think that's a key part of the equation. So it's really a combination of all of those kinds of things. But the most important thing is we let them do their jobs and recognize that they're very skilled, they're very experienced, and we hire them because of that. And we want them to be successful and want to support them in doing that. And I think that model, especially as you get into bigger companies that are more focused on the quarter as opposed to, the next 3 or 5 or 10 years, it feels different. I always used to say we managed to the lowest common denominator in the big firm that I was with previously. We don't do that here. We really do allow people a lot more latitude, and we think they are much more successful and much more satisfied as a result. Mm-hmm.